you keep running here. Okay. Today is November 1st, wow, 2010. And once again, I say hello to my students in front of me and all those listening across the expanse of the universe. We're in the middle of conservative Judaism. We're dealing with the seminary, and today in particular is a very, very important lecture because we come to a transitional point. Last week, we devoted the last 2 weeks to Rav Shaul Lieberman, and there's no question that with Rav Shaul Lieberman, we're dealing with a personality who is very hard to understand why he was at JTS. He remained Orthodox. He said he was Orthodox. He made no claims to the contrary. You're not dealing here with Solomon Schechter or Louis Ginsberg. You're not dealing here with Professor Finkelstein. You're dealing here with Reb Shaul Liebman or Gadol Sheva Gedolim. Of course, he got involved with Chochmat Yisrael and the financial problems, and he himself justified his being at the seminary that it enabled him to do his research and to be able to publish something he could not have done anywhere else. His tenure at the seminary, as I said last week, it involved the relationship with Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, who was his cousin by marriage. And certainly when you talk about the joint base, then even though Mark Shapiro feels it's not proper, I think that is the term that Louis Bernstein uses and Wolf Kellman uses, and it's the term that I feel comfortable with. It would have been a tremendous moment for American Judaism. It would have solved endless problems of Mamzeret. But it never worked out, and as I said last week, probably the real reason it never worked out is because Professor Liebman could not deliver the entire rabbinical assembly, and we'll come to that later today. But there's no question that the relationship between the Rav and Rav Shaul Liebman was a fascinating one. The Rav's comment on the Kohen being Musar and Sheretz, and you know, they say it's another tradition. So someone quoted to me Rav Heschel Schechter that he also mentioned, as the Rav did, that not every gon was a gon in the sense that we use it. The reason was that the yeshiva in Babylonia was called Gaon Yaakov. So anyone who was a Rosh Yeshiva there was called the Gaon Yaakov. And not everyone was such a gaon. It's not the term we use today. Today, of course, the term is totally watered down and it's meaningless. If you read the Haredi press, every rabbi is automatically called Harav HaGaon. So when everyone is a Rav HaGaon, everyone is a Rav HaGaon. And there are perhaps a few Gaonim alive, there's no question. But it's, you can count them on the fingers of two hands, maybe even one hand. It's not something that can widely be used. But this is our generation, we have to live with it. And whenever I pick up a Haredi newspaper, I feel bad for the rabbis, because everyone has a title that is decided upon from on high. This one is Harav HaGaon, Harav HaGaon HaGadol. This one is Maran Posek Hadar, Maran Rosh Yeshiva, and I feel bad for those who don't have those beautiful august titles. Now, let me go one step further and show you something extremely fascinating. Yitz is not here. This is exactly what Yitz asked me. On the seminary faculty, there was another figure who in reality played a very small role in the seminary per se, and yet outside of the seminary, he became a classic figure. And that, of course, is Avram Yoshua Heschel. So I just want to say a few words about him. First of all, to put him into context, his years 1907-1972. And Professor Heschel came from a tremendous Hasidic family. He was a great-great-great-great-grandson of the Abdur Rav, from whom he was named. And he was related to every Rebbe in the Rishon, a dynasty that you can mention. He was related to the Kapishnitzer. He was related, he was the Munda Kapishnitzer's Anenikal, the grandson. He was related to the Biyana. He was related to the Meshbitzer. And until today, whenever you meet anyone named Heschel, they are related to Professor Avraham Yehoshua Heschel. Now, his life story is fascinating. He studied in yeshiva in his youth. He was a Hasidic kid. He was being groomed for Hasidic leadership. And then later he winds up in the University of Berlin, and he's exposed there already to a scientific approach. He studies at the Hochschule, which was I would call it a university for scientific Jewish studies. And at that university where he studied, he was exposed to some of the greatest Chachmei Yisrael at the time. Some of them were strictly Orthodox, some of them were partially Orthodox, some of them were what we call historical school, which the conservative movement claims as its own. And he went into the field of Jewish philosophy and theology. He's thrown out of Germany as an Als Jud, as not being a native German, being a Pole. He's sent to Poland. He remains a few months in Poland with miracles. Literally the summer before Hitler overruns Poland, the Hebrew Union College rescues him, brings him to America, and he teaches the Hebrew Union College till about 1945. Obviously, he was unhappy, he was a misfit at Hebrew Union College, because we're talking in the 40s, at that time, Reform Judaism was in its prime, in its zenith, and I would add the word, in its extreme. And here you have a person who is Shomer Torah Mitzvah, who is Chassidish, with all that he has absorbed from the great world beyond him, from the secular world, from the scientific world, from the Wissenschaft world, but the heart remains a very dedicated Jewish heart. About 1945, he's redeemed, he comes to teach at JTS. Now it's fascinating, at JTS, he was always put down. Mordechai Kaplan was still a prominent figure. Now Mordechai Kaplan considered him a tyro. What does he know about philosophy? What does he know about theology? And Professor Lieberman, who of course was the leading faculty member at JTS, was a Litvak through and through. And here you're bringing in a Hasidish guy who, in Lieberman's opinion, barely knew how to touch up a Gemara with Shas and Paiskim, and he's teaching philosophy and theology and Hasidus. And of course, to Lieberman, this was, as I told you, I don't want to use Lieberman's word that it's attributed to him, but you know, the word is Narishkeit. I don't want to use that word because I don't think it does justice, but certainly it's not Basaviyayin. It's not the meat and potatoes that Chazal speak about, that the Poskim speak about. It's not the heart of Torah Hashem Tamima. So Kaplan looked down upon him, Lieberman looked down upon him, and of course this affected the relationship of the students to Avraham Yehoshua Heschel. He was never allowed to teach postgraduate courses. All his years at the seminary, he essentially taught on a collegiate level, taught in the rabbinic school, but never the postgraduate courses. So you see, on one hand, here is the great Professor Heschel, and he's very thwarted. Klapei chutz, he becomes civil rights, he demonstrates, he has certain attitudes, he's quoted in the New York Times, when he appears in public, this is not Liebman. If you ever saw Professor Liebman up close, you would believe he was Irish. He didn't look Jewish. He was clean shaven. He absolutely, in my eyes, when I saw him up close, I thought to myself, why, he's Irish. And you look at the Professor Heschel with a beard, with a shtanz, and he was an actor, he was a performer. when he would address the Gentiles, when he would address the civil rights workers, when he would address a rally against Vietnam, America's participation, he would appear without a kippah, and then he would want to drink water, as every speaker does occasionally, to wet your vocal cords, that should be less strained. You follow me, Shmuel? He would very dramatically put on a kippah and make a bracha. You understand? And when he made a bracha in public, wow, the world was shaking. It was, the New York Times called attention to it. So, you see, Rabbi Yeshua Heschel, it was klapei pnim, he did not enjoy great kavod. Klapei chutz, I don't think there was any faculty member of the seminary who was more revered and more respected than Professor Heschel. Now, his writings are magnificent. And I don't know if I've ever told you, but I was told that the Rav, I actually heard it on a tape, where the Rav said he wished he could write like Professor Heschel, like Rav Avraham Yeshua Heschel. His command of English, Hebrew, Yiddish, was literally native. It's really amazing how well he had a knack with languages. You see, that is a gift, that his English, you wouldn't believe that his English was not native. And he wrote beautifully in Hebrew, he wrote magnificently in Yiddish. And I don't have to tell you, the earth is the Lord, the Sabbath. He wrote about rabbinic tradition, Medrash, endless volumes that have been translated. He wrote some volumes in English, some volumes in Hebrew. They're translations, Hebrew to English, English to Hebrew. I can only tell you that my only living Rebbe, should live and be well, is Rebbe Yosef Weiss. And some of you may recognize the name. Danny, is his name still known in the yeshiva? Rebbe Yosef Weiss. Well, once a person hits 90, gone and forgotten. Anyway, Rebbe Yosef Weiss, Talmud Mufuker, Rebbe Moshe Soloveitchik, was my second Rebbe in the yeshiva. Later he taught Jorodei, and he was a very fascinating individual, came from a Safma background, studied in Tehre Vadas, transferred to uptown to Yeshiva College to study with Rebbe Moshe Soloveitchik, became very close to the Soloveitchik family. I don't say he became a total YU person. His children were not educated in YU, but certainly was at home in YU and remained on the faculty for 60 years, I would say, or more. He joined the faculty in 1940, and he was still there in the early 2000s. So one Shavuot, I ate at my Rebbe's house. So here I am in Washington Heights. He was married to the great-granddaughter of Rav Shmuel Fuld Hirsch. He was married to Dr. Raphael Mahler's daughter. Anyone know who Dr. Raphael Mahler was? He was the president of Kehillat Adat Yeshurun, of Rabbi Breuer's congregation. And he himself was a grandson of Rav Hirsch. So Mori Rebbe, Rav Yosef Weiss, was married to his daughter, and he had, you know, an apartment covered with svarim all over. And then towards the end of the meal, when we warmed up and we were a little bit not so sober, he opened up the closet door, a closet, the Bronx apartment, the Washington Heights apartment, the closet. You people have grown up in luxury with walk-in closets, you have closets bigger than my whole apartment in Jerusalem. But one time he had a little closet, he opened up the closet was filled with svarim, he didn't want anyone to see. And in the middle of the closet were all of Reb Avraham Yeshua Heschel's svarim. And Reb Weiss told me, these svarim, this is it. In other words, if you want Yerid Shemayim, you want to have emotion, you have to study Professor Heschel's svarim. So this was Heschel, and this was his role at the seminary. He married rather late. He married at the age of about 39. He married a very interesting woman, a concert pianist, which in itself speaks of Professor Heschel, his background, his broadness, where he was coming from, where he was at. And they had one child, a daughter. And she today is a conservative rabbi. I don't know if she practices. I believe she's in scholarship. She's a professor. But they had one child out of a marriage that began very late. Now, I just want to tell you, in my article in Tradition, I quote the sources, and I speak about the fact that Professor Lieberman and Professor Heschel did not get along. And, of course, the most basic reason, he joined Lieberman on the seminary faculty in 1945 as professor of Jewish ethics and mysticism. Heschel's world was that of the non-legal aspects of the rabbinic tradition, while Lieberman was the master of the legal elements in the halakha. Heschel descended from passionate chassidim, while Lieberman was born and bred a Litvak. Shaicher and Spiro theorize that these differences were at the heart of their difficult, troublesome relationship. And then they go on to something else. There's another reason why they didn't get along. Heschel was a major opponent, outspoken, of the Vietnamese War, the American involvement. Now, historians, it's a little bit too early to judge the period, but I can tell you this. Historians will one day write that the downfall of American ethics, moral society, begins with the opposition to the Vietnamese War. The students started rebelling. College campuses were aflame. This is caught up beyond opposition to the Vietnamese War. It's caught up with feminism, with liberalism, with all that rocked the campuses in the 60s into the 70s, the sexual revolution. Jews were involved in all these rebellions. At times, they were the leaders. At times, you're talking Jews who were, 4% of the American population, 2% of the American population, were 60, 70% of the leaders of all these movements. And the opposition to Vietnam succeeded. And Professor Heschel was outstanding in his opposition, spoke at the rallies, electrified the crowds, brought the prestige of an Einikel, of the Abderav, of the Kapishnitsa, of the Biyana, of the Meshbitsa, etc., etc., to his stance and viewpoint. Professor Lieberman, on the other hand, would never criticize America, never criticize the president, never come out against the government. And Spiro and Shaichet, who were students of both, claim that this difference in Hashkafa exacerbated the tensions on an intellectual level between them. And they have a theory which I believe is absolutely correct. They say as follows. It's very easy to understand these two people. Heschel never tasted poverty. How many of you are descendants of the Ruzhina dynasty? Do you know what the expression means in Yiddish? A Ruzhina Einikel. No, David, you know what that means? You know a shtickle Yiddish? Yeah. I have a very good friend, Chaya Marcus. Her maiden name was Heschel. You know her. She's related. When they have a simcha, you should see how the women wear jewelry. This is a Ruzhina and Einikel. Chaya once explained to me that a Ruzhina and Einikel does not appear in public without jewelry. It's a certain concept. They did not lack. They were royalty in the Hasidic world. What's the word? Remember I gave lectures 5-6 years ago? Malchut. Remember my lectures? Remember how I explained that the beautiful lectures, important to understand. Malchut. Abraham Yeshua Heschel was in Berlin.
You give a different twist to it.
Just listen. Don't be a Marxist. You got to understand Heschel now.
I see them living in poverty. And
I dealt with that. Yitzchak, please, your memory is faulty. I dealt with that 5, 6 years, 7. 5-6 years ago, I dealt with that. I explained that to you. It's like the Beis Hamikdash.
The
Makom Shein Lo Glam, the Gemara and Pesachim. Good, good, good. Relax yourself. Relax yourself. But watch. Watch.
You can understand the different
view. Yeah, I understand. I don't live with Malkin. I'm the last one in the world. When you see me wearing a suit, you'll make a Shechayonu in Israel. In America, never. When I go among the Romans, I have to dress so I give. I have to speak in public. I have to wear a suit. I'm going. That's a king. We are going. But here, in Shabbos, I wear a tie. But generally, when I speak and it's the summer and I get upkehitzed, I take, by then they know me, I take off the tie, I throw it on the floor, and I tell them on one thing the Satmar Rebbe and Rav Kook agreed, that a tie has no purpose in life whatsoever. It's the only item of clothing that chokes you and has no purpose. A belt has a purpose, a shirt has a purpose, pants have a purpose, a tie licked in dread. Now, back here. So Professor Heschel, he was raised in luxury, on Einikel. He goes to Berlin. The Rav knew him from Berlin, by the way. He's whined, he's dined. Everyone wants to be in the presence of the Abdu Ravs on Einikel. No, he comes to America. He comes to Cincinnati. He's whined and dined. He comes to uptown New York, to 122 in Broadway. He's whined and dined. Professor Heschel lived under the communists. May I quote him? You'll find the source in Spiro and Scheuchert. Professor Lieberman lived under, thank you. Just wanted to see if you're awake. Professor Lieberman, whenever they corrected the Rav, that was the Rav's Zvadich, but Gavel Sein as Mazait Nochvar. He wanted to see if you're still awake. But your mind runs ahead of you. The Rav always confused Lulav and Etrog, Kiddush Hagdalah. You understand terms like that. So I just confused Lieberman with Heschel. So I'm a Zangezud. Professor Lieberman lived under the communists. Quote, I lived like a dog. These were his words under the communists. So here's a man lived under the communists, ran away, reached Israel. You don't know what communism was. You understand? And even today, you can visit parts of Russia, you will be amazed at the poverty. You will be amazed at the facilities. Russia was a Potemkin village under the communists. We were frightened stiff, but we didn't know the reality. Who can forget 57 with Sputnik, what happened in America, with the articles and tradition, red or dead? In other words, is it better to be a communist or should you kill yourself and fight to the end if the communists are fighting America? But you have no idea what a farce it was. The poverty, the lack of food, the starvation, the 1920s, the 1930s. Then he comes to Israel. And we told you that there's one theory, he didn't even have enough money to take care of his ill wife. And here he comes to America. What a country. Oh, how wonderful. Money, dollars, dignity, no anti-Semitism, freedom, New York Times, Daily News, Daily Mirror at that time, New York Post, Herald Tribune, endless newspapers, no censorship. Chas v'chalila, you should say one word against the American government. And this is what they attribute the difference between the two professors. Michael Watch, you want to know something amazing? I think this is absolutely true about two brothers who are the most precious, important, greatest brothers I had the privilege of knowing in my life. Mori Urebi, Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, and Mori Urebi, and dear friend, colleague, I would say, Talmud Chaver, is Rabbi Aaron Halevi Soloveitchik. And you know what's amazing? The Rav was exactly like Lieberman. Don't say one word against American involvement in Vietnam. He was furious with the demonstrations and the Jews involved. And he said, they don't know what they're doing, now we'll demonstrate against Vietnam, and then people will demonstrate against American support of Israel. And he went to the barricades not to demonstrate, not to shame the president. And Baron Halevi Soloveitchik, fire came out of his mouth against the Vietnam involvement. America, murderers, commentators, screaming headlines. Hamabas says, screaming headlines. And you start to think, Ma bein Reb Yosef Dov Halevi to Reb Aaron Halevi? And the answer stares you in the eyes, Mendel. You can't escape it. 15 years separate them. The Rav, 14 years. No, 15 years. The Rav was born, or it could be 14 and a half years, I'll compromise. The Rav was born 1903. Where was he born? White Russia. Saw the communist takeover. Starvation. Escaped to Warsaw. Absolute poverty. Managed to get through Berlin. His father worked to the bone to send him an occasional check. I happen to have known the person in America, the Talmud of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who went to the post office and placed the money order sending the money to the Rav in Berlin. You know who it was, Yitzchak? Rabbi Dr. Mendel Lewinis. Yeah, he was the one. Hold on, let me just finish, then I'll open it. I just want to... Menachem, what's your name?
No.
So wait, you're not even on the list. I'm going to be all confused. Do me a favor. You're going to come regularly? You're in second year Torah Tshuva?
First year.
You can understand my language first year?
You're trying?
Say that. Here, just put your name here. Give me a drop of background, okay? And you're not cutting a class to come at all, get into trouble with Rabbi David, I know.
No, of course not.
Okay, thank you. Gentlemen, the Rav came to America, wealth, money, independence, intellectual greatness, New England, Harvard, Yale, Radcliffe, Wesley, MIT. You know what Tova Lichtenstein taught me? A Webster unabridged word. My father was a Brahmin. Brahmin. Look it up in the unabridged. Not like the Indian caste. A Brahmin. Nothing greater than New England. From America. Thanksgiving Day. The Red Sox. He couldn't oppose America. Reb Aaron? Where was he born? What do you know about Europe? He came to America, a kid of 13. He celebrated his bar mitzvah in Warsaw. He never saw the communists. He has no memory of Fruzhana. He has no memory of Haslovich. He has no memory of crossing the border in the middle of the night at Sakonet Nefashot. Okay, his early memories. Warsaw, Rav Yitzchak Kutner, his private tutor, preparing him for his bar mitzvah. By the time he was 12, his father already was in America. The family was waiting to join them. Comes to America, right into his father's shir. From the day he arrived in America, can I have that paper back, please? From the day he arrived in America, he was younger than you. He was 13 years of age. He went into his father's class. He never had another different Rebbe. Went to MTA. What could be bad about MTA? What an education I received in MTA. Yeshiva College. Was kein sein schlecht. What an education I got in Yeshiva College. America? He had no fear. He had no fear complaining, yelling, shouting, demonstrating. Rav Aaron, America, freedom, born, live with it, the right to express an opinion. He didn't kiss the ground of America. He never tasted the bitterness of communism. The Rav, America? Wow. The president? Washington? The capital? Wow. Noach, are you related to Reb Moshe Feinstein?
No.
You're not from that small family? You know what I'm talking about. Reb Moshe's brother-in-law was Rabbi Small of Chicago, of the Midwest. Okay. Gentlemen, I may be right, I may be wrong, but the theory sure holds water.
Are you going to discuss that Heschel in the beginning was anti-Zionist and raised
Chinese? Listen, if to give a course on Heschel, it's Heschel, but it doesn't affect his status at the seminary. But he certainly became a great Zionist. You can't. His earlier years, he was influenced by his own background. He was influenced by the flourishing community in Berlin. He was influenced by what the Jews achieved in Vienna. He came to America and he was influenced by the reform movement, but by then already the cracks already were on the wall. And by the time he reached the seminary, I wouldn't say it was anti-Zionist. By that point already, he was much more open to the Zionist dream. With the establishment of the State of Israel, I don't think there was a trace of anti-Zionism left in Avraham Yehoshua Heschel. But it doesn't affect his status at the seminary. What does affect it is that Kaplan didn't consider him a great philosopher, and Kaplan stood at influence, and Professor Liebman didn't consider him a big Talmud Chacham, and he certainly had influence. And yet, klapei chutz, no one heard of Kaplan, no one heard of Lieberman, but every minister and every priest across the length and breadth of the United States heard of Professor Avraham Yehoshua Heschel. It's an interesting comment. Yes, Michael.
I think there are two major issues. Number one is I think you're putting entirely too much emphasis on economics. But let's take Heschel first of all.
Well, one second. It's not me. It's the biographers. I'm quoting them.
What informed Heschel's Judaism was a deep belief in the responsibility of Jews to participate in gaining social justice.
Mankind.
In the world in which they live.
Tikkun, yes. I understand.
You know, and that was a deep sense of who he was.
Right. So you feel
that's
that...
number one. I think there's a more serious issue.
Yeah, you...
Number one, your argument. Yeah. If you go back now, rewind 25 years.
Right.
You could use your argument to justify why the Jews didn't protest against the American government about what was happening in Europe.
No. Why are you protesting?
With a tremendously poor population that was terribly threatened, that was terribly insecure, of being accused of being un-American, and they believe that all hell would break loose, so to speak, if they demonstrate.
Look, one second.
The upper class, the Brahmin class of Jews.
Right.
The Frankfurters and the Brandeises and
the Weises, yeah.
They didn't do anything.
And the Silvers, no.
I mean, they're scathing articles about
Frankfurters. Right, no, they're not scathing articles. Their entire PhD thesis done on the topic. So I only want to answer you that, first of all, it's not my theory. The theory is Shoichid and Spiro, who knew both Professors Lieberman and Heschel. So I only took the theory one step further and applied it to my Rebbe and the Baruch. But
Lieberman's whole sense of who he was completely different than Heschel.
Right, I understand. So you feel the economic... Fine, so go back to the first point.
So you
differ with the two Talmidim. It's fine, I don't differ with you. As far as Tikkun Olam, there you're absolutely right that because of Heschel's philosophic stance, like I said many times, all my years in yeshiva as a student, I never heard the word Tikkun Olam. All right, you learn Shas and Poskim, you don't hear the word Tikkun Olam. Obviously, we have to be a light to the nations, and this is important, but the first responsibility is at home. Heschel got involved in Tikkun Olam, and I don't know which came first, whether it was theologically or his exposure. His exposure brought about the theological stance. But you're right, I'm not here to go into great detail. I only want to deal with Heschel in his relationship with Professor Lieberman. But Heschel in the seminary, what's amazing is a man who was so well known outside the seminary did not play a major role in the seminary. In shaping the youth and shaping the minds, he had very few Talmidim in comparison to the Talmudic faculty, which is an interesting comment, and it may have
many of the rabbis.
Excuse me.
A tremendous impact on many of the rabbis.
On some of the rabbis, I would say, not many. There were some that became philosophers, theologians, but the dominant influence was the rabbinic faculty, and they kept Heschel out of the ultimate teaching positions. But the Seder, we're going to talk about what happened in the seminary and what happened in conservative Judaism in 1 minute, because everything we're talking about becomes obsolete following World War II.
Hey, would you use this argument to justify the behavior of the Jews in
1940, 45? No, chas v'chalila, the behavior of the Jews.
That's the same argument.
I don't agree with you that I don't think they were economically depressed. I think they were brainwashed by Roosevelt. I think it is true they were loyal to America beyond description. America could do no wrong. Roosevelt could do no wrong.
And they weren't going to demonstrate
it. And the Agudat Yisrael took the attitude, chas v'chalila, to demonstrate shtadlanut. So part of it is true that we can criticize on the level that America could do no wrong, which was a terrible mistake. And the Rav said this openly. The Rav said it was our greatest mistake. I have it in my book, quoting the Rav word by word. But Nachum, yeah.
Yeah. Why the two brothers disagreed about Vietnam. He gave the same answer you did.
Okay, to say that, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, having known the Rav and having known Reb Aaron, to me it makes a lot of sense. But again, theories come and go. Also, Rav Shmuel said it, thank you, so I have a big achi samach. But I'm not going to convince Michael if he feels that the economic issue is not the spiron. I could say the same thing about the professors Lieberman and Heschel. They knew both of them. Yes, Avital.
What was Heschel teaching
at the UCSF? Philosophy, Jewish philosophy, theology, Hasidus. This was his field. He never taught Talmud. Medrash. But they looked at him as a lightweight compared to Lieberman and the Zimitrovsky and Sofer. These were the heavyweights. They did not let him teach Talmud. And
because he really wasn't capable?
Look, the man had to know how to learn a Daf Gemara, but his whole approach was very different than the Litvisha Halachist, etc. Yes?
So they had a problem teaching doubt philosophy?
I can't answer. I wasn't a student there, but from what I gather from afar, from the memoir literature, the Lieberman set the, if you want to be a serious student, you got to learn Shas and Poskim. You can't waste your time with Heschel. That was the atmosphere that was set at the seminary. And the truth is, the view that came out of it, Talmidei Chachamim and serious students were, of course, Talmidim of Lieberman. But then again, they were the ones who didn't remain in the rabbinate long. Even if they went into the rabbinate, they afterwards went into teaching and education, and they went in already to scholarship. It was a different field. I want to end off this part of the lectures by citing one very important letter. You see, from all that we've said and all that we have described from 1902 to 1945, it's obvious that it's very difficult to describe the seminary. Was it Orthodox? Was it conservative? Was it reform? Was it revolutionary? Was it innovative? The truth is, it had everything in it. And you could find in the seminary what you were looking for. You could make a strong case, the seminary, Orthodox. Then, of course, you had the problem of Kaplan. How could you let Kaplan teach? Louis Ginsberg had various periods in his life. In his youth, he was a tremendous advocate of biblical criticism, Wellhausen. Later in life, he said, "I was wrong." Nevertheless, he published endless volumes, Legends of the Jews, and you can see the overtones of a total different approach to what is sacred to a Torah Jew to Louis Ginsberg. It was Kodesh v'Chomesh from Shem Be'Avuvia. I think that's the best way to describe it. There was a feeling of awe and reverence. On the other hand, he could handle a Christian commentary and tie it right in with the Midrash, a Christian tradition, a Catholic tradition. And yet Louis Ginsberg was a giant of Torah. You talk about Saul Lieberman, there of course you have the heart of the problem, because Lieberman himself was strictly Orthodox, and yet here he was, lending his name, his prestige, his good reputation to the seminary. But if you want to see a document that shows you how difficult it is to describe the seminary, I want to quote to you one letter from that appears in Mark Shapiro's work, the Professor Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox. This document appears, if you're familiar with that little booklet, there's the part dealing with Lieberman and the Orthodox, and then on the other side, Mark reproduces letters, correspondence. As I recall, most of them or all of them in Hebrew. On page 4, the part with the letters, you have an unbelievable document dated Yud Chet Shvat, 1936. You won't believe who wrote this letter and what it's about. L'chvod harav hagon hagadol b'chulu malach u'kvodo Reb Levi Ginsberg Neiro Yair. Do you know who's writing with all those titles you just heard? And this was 1936. It's not that Levi Ginsberg is an unknown entity. This letter is by Reb Moshe HaLevi Soloveitchik. And you know what the letter is about? Acherei drishat ha-shalom. Hineni bezel ha-hamid lefnei malat kvod gadluto et shdidi ha-gol ha-metsuyan ha-rab Yitzchak Chutna Neiro Yair me-Warsha. Do you understand what's happening here? Yitzchak Rab Chutna had just arrived in America. Reb Moshe Soloveitchik knew him from Warsaw. Reb Moshe is writing this letter to Louis Ginsberg because Reb Yitzchak Chutna asked him to write a letter of introduction. Yodeu makia nochi oto chetreit mikvacha yamim lebal kishron gadol. V'hu echad mi yechidi skula ben hadoch hatzayir tamad chacham v'gaon mubhak. V'yidiyat v'avanat ha-torah v'vlon muvan hamila. You hear what he's writing about Reb Yitzchak Chutna? He's a youngster who's great. A giant, one of the few in the new generation who really has tremendous knowledge. Mechadesh kiddush le'Torah b'chomet k'sat ha'Torah b'derech yisharon ha'chomet b'yidiyah v'ura. He's mechadesh kiddushim in the entire gamut of rabbinic literature. V'kvayot zolo minutim, monitin is an Aramaic word or a Greek word, I guess Professor Liebman would know its sources, that crawled into rabbinic Hebrew. And it means he is well known. He has pirsomet. How would you say it? I guess in modern Hebrew too. Yatzalo monitin. It could be they use it too. B'sifro Torah Tanazim Masechet Avodah Zarah. What would you say?
Monitin is a reputation.
But what is that? Monitin. That's what we're saying. Exactly. And it's used in modern Hebrew, right?
Yeah.
It's still the monitin, but the source is not a Hebrew word. It's something Greek Latin. But and already Rav Chutna had written Torat Nazir, Masechtet Nazir. That was Rav Chutna's famous work when he was still a young man. Ukashamati me'ito. I've heard from Rav Chutna sheyesh lo inyan lemalat kvod gulato. He wants to talk to you about something. Rosella vakro. He wants to visit you. Al kein bati lahakiro b'kdei sheyikablenu b'kavet haru'i lo. Therefore, I've written this letter that you should receive him with the honor that he deserves. U'birchat kol tov lamat kvod gdulato mokiro u'mechabdo Moshe HaLevi Soloveitchik. My dear students, if you want to be mixed up, how do you describe JTS? just read that letter. Now, what Nachum just said, that seems to be the theory in the vogue, that this letter was written because Rav Chutna wanted a job at JTS. He was looking for Panassi. He had just arrived in America. He was looking around. He wanted a place. Maybe he wanted guidance. Maybe he wanted to go on to get a doctorate in Talmud. Who did he want to meet with? Professor Louis Ginsberg, Levi Ginsberg, at JTS. And who writes a letter of recommendation? Reb Moshe Halevi Soloveitchik. So, wow. Now, this document, I can assure you, if you were to hang it up in Yeshiva Rabbeinu Chaim Berlin today, they'd have a lot of difficulty with it. They'd probably rip it off the bulletin board, claim it's false, that it never happened. But I can say, Eidut Nemanan, my Talmud, Rabbi, Dr. Professor Mark Shapiro, that this is a valid document. Whether we can understand it, not understand it, have to understand the times, we don't know exactly, perhaps they're wrong, he didn't want a job, but the document speaks for itself. Louis Ginsberg, Reb Yitzchak Chutna, and Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. And let me say, Professor Louis Ginsberg, let me give him a title. So, gentlemen, the seminary from 1902 to 1945, very difficult to characterize. No question there were trends within it. If Mordechai Kaplan had not been there, the entire story of American Orthodoxy would be different today. It's hard to predict what would have been, what Yeshiva University would be like. There's no doubt that YU would have swallowed up JTS ultimately. There's no doubt in my mind that Bernard Rebel Graduate School would have gone on to heights that it has never achieved had it had some of the faculty. How the Soloveitchik family would have gotten along with Professor Ginsberg. But you see, Reb Moshe writes a letter like this, that the Soloveitchik family could have gotten along with Professor Lieberman in Bernard Rebel Graduate School is not even a question. It's obvious that they may have had different approaches, but the commitment to Yirat Shemayim, La Halacha L'Maisa, would have been overwhelming. But that's the story through 1945.
Now, what about the, is there a possibility to say that Heschel was an anchor, a counterweight to Kaplan?
That may very well be why Kaplan did not like him. In other words, that's what everyone says, whispers, that the real source of the enmity was the fact that here Kaplan had a monopoly on Jewish philosophy, and he was so distant from halacha as a binding force and so distance from God and revelation. And here along comes Professor Heschel, who later writes books on these very topics, revelation, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, understanding HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right or wrong with the Midrash, what he has written, and it's beautiful. The man's writing, the Sabbath is the Lord. Oh my, the earth, what is the one where with God seeks man seeks God? What's the one, the earth? God in searching man. And okay, so this was very the opposite of Kaplan. So what you say may be absolutely true. I mean, obviously it may be 100% true, but you can't say I hate a guy because he believes in God and I don't. So you come out already. He's not a philosopher. He's not on the same level. His knowledge doesn't equal mine, etc., etc. Where does he have a PhD from? I'm a graduate of the great Columbia University. Okay.
So he's a guy in German university.
I'm not certain. I know that in Germany you could get a PhD. It was very simple. A bachelor's, you didn't need a master's, you get a PhD. I can't evaluate. But there's no question that there was a chasm between them that was unbelievable. Now, I just want to read certain aspects here. I got correspondence from London from my student there, Rabbi Yisrael Phillips, who I met when I visited London last winter. So he's been listening to the lectures, and he made some very interesting points. He says the story of Mordechai Kaplan reminds him of the late Rabbi Dr. Louis Jacobs, the founder of the Masorati movement in England. And here about Louis Jacobs, some of you asked me after class. So he tells us here he had a traditional yeshiva education. He studied at the Manchester Yeshiva. He studied in the Gateshead Kollel. Was an outstanding Talmud Chacham. Like Kaplan, Rabbi Jacobs was for a time an assistant rabbi at an Orthodox shul. He was assistant to the late Rabbi Monk at the Golders Green Base Medrash, which is a Yekesha congregation in the heart of Golders Green. And he was principal of Jews College. And Rabbi Jacobs was invited to succeed Rabbi Dr. Isidore Epstein, who we mentioned in class. And by that time, he had published his work, We Have Reason to Believe. And the Orthodox community vetoed his appointment, vetoed his becoming chief rabbi, and the whole schism begins, and he is Masorati. So he makes the comparison to Mordechai Kaplan. Of course, there's one basic difference between them. Louis Jacobs believed in God. That was never, Judaism as a civilization was never part of his theology. But the historic development of the halakha did play a role in his thinking. In practice he was from, but then again, Mordechai Kaplan in practice was from. He also didn't carry on Shabbos. Okay, secondly, I mentioned in class that the chief rabbi of England, Rabbi Nathan Adler, I thought he was a grandson of Reb Nissen Adler. I knew he was named for Reb Nissen Adler. It turns out that he writes to Reb Nissen Adler, did not have any children. He was named for Reb Nissen Adler. He probably is a relative. A great nephew. So I wasn't, if I mentioned in class a grandson, I want to correct myself. I knew he was related and he was named for Reb Nissen Adler. So I thank you, he was a great nephew, which I believe I knew, but I must have slipped on my tongue. Now, Chief Rabbi Hertz we mentioned in class, but this is very interesting. In the Sunday class, when I dealt with Kinos, I mentioned Reverend Singer of the Singer Prayer Book and Reverend Abraham Rosenfeld, who translated the Kinos and Slicha into English. And he tells me, I put the word Reverend in quotes as they were both, in fact, ordained Orthodox rabbis. Everyone I know called them Reverend Rosenthal, Reverend Singer. So he explains to me, it's just at that time they lived, at the time they lived, the only person in the United Synagogue entitled to call himself rabbi was the chief rabbi. So all the other rabbanim had to be satisfied with the appellation of Reverend. Strange. When you think about it, if one is a chief rabbi, that presupposes that one is chief of other rabbis. So anyway, it's a very interesting letter from Rabbi Yisrael Phillips, and if anyone wants a copy afterwards, I have two copies here. If anyone wants, they can take. Fascinating, and I thank Rabbi Phillips for his emendations. I also want to mention, I have here Xeroxes of my article on Rav Shaul Liebman. There's enough to go around, whoever wants, and for class, you're welcome to take. Now, I want to move into the big leagues now. Now we're coming into Michael Miller's territory. Noah, you are small, one day you will be big. Conservative movement was conquering America. Conquering America. This is post-World War II. You're in the late 40s. And what do you have in America now? You see, time marches on. There are drastic changes. Right in Yeshiva University, there are drastic changes. The Yeshiva University you go to is not the Yeshiva University I went to. I'll give you simple examples. I never in my life saw the Rav or Rav David Lifshitz or Rav Yaakov Moshe Cohen Lessen or any of the other Gedolim in YU in my time give a shiur with their hat on. If someone put their hat on, it would be an insult to the audience. It means you're in a rush to leave. You're getting set to go outside. Today I see pictures. Rebbeim giving shiur. You give out here to catch the students to go to YU. The Abraham program gives out a folder. There's a different folder for the girls, a different folder for the boys. The folder for the boys, I see Yedidi Reb Heschel Shechter giving a shiur surrounded by students wearing a hat. A different world. People sit down to eat. Sudat Shabbat, they wear a hat, the whole Sudah. In my days, if you wore a hat during the Sudah, I told you, you couldn't get a shtelah. You're disrespectful to women. I yet saw Rabbanim Talmidim of the Meitzer Tiluy. When they went into the elevator in my building, Rabbi Nathan Drazen would take his hat off if a woman was in the elevator with him and hold it over his heart. My wife told me, that's respect for women. All right, it's a different generation. I walked into the Beis Medrash about 5-6 years ago. I gave a shiur in the yeshiva. I walked into Daven Mincha. And everyone turns and faces Amsterdam Avenue, not the Yeren HaKodesh. My days, I saw Gedolei Yisrael davening in the yeshiva. And everyone faced the Yeren HaKodesh. It's a different generation, a different world, a different raison d'etre. What can I tell you? Different environment. The world changes. I was flabbergasted when I saw everyone turns away from the Aron HaKodesh. And what bothered me is I saw the Rav davening and the David Lifshitz davening and Yaakov Moshe Cohen Lessen davening, Rav Shmuel Gerstenfeld davening, Rav Palayev davening, Rav Sharon Palayev davening. And then when I came back, I happened to mention it to Tova. She said when she saw it, she went berserk. Baruch Hashem, that I think like a son of Achik. It doesn't matter who's that. There are changes. Life is not stagnant. Don't like the changes? I don't like them. But what can I do? I'll come to this. When I finish up in serving the Jews, then I'm going to speak about Chovei Torah and rebelling and all that goes into it.
You better begin
Yitzchak, I want God to keep you alive to hear my lectures in Das Torah. So the more I put them off, the more you're going to live in health and happiness. So don't complain. That God have mercy. All our friends are dying one by one, and you're carrying on Das Torah. Lorraine Glicker Gatsworth just died. I couldn't believe my ears. David Lubish just died. We have friends who are critical. What? You don't know what's going on in our neighborhood? I don't answer the phone in my house. Every phone call I get, give me good news. That's terrible. We will get there. Ribbono Shel Olam, don't let me depart.
I have a feeling I'm listening to this lecture up in Shemayim.
No. You're listening right here. We got enough up in Shemayim in your family. Good news. Ribbono Shel Olam, keep Yitz Reuben alive, not just to hear my lecture on Das Torah, but to hear my what I have planned on Jew and general culture, and even beyond that, keep them alive. Okay?
Amen.
These youngsters here don't know what we're up against. You don't understand that. No, we're up against. Take my word for it. Read Sefer Kohelet, and don't tell me Bikshu Chazal ignored that Sefer Kohelet. Figure out why they kept it, and you'll understand why every word is true. Gentlemen, Lahabdil, between changes at yeshiva, everything we said about the seminary is very nice, but the seminary was out there all across America. And now you have to understand, the East European Jews, by now, are 90% of American Jewry. You have some German Jews, Batel B'Shishim. You have some descendants yet of the Spanish Portuguese Jews, Batel B'Elef. You have some Sephardic Jews, Batel B'Revavot. But the East European Jews, we all descend from them. And now there's a second generation, there's a third generation, there's even a fourth generation. And they're totally cut off from real Yiddishkeit. They're not at home in a Reformed temple yet. They want a conservative temple. But they want a conservative temple that they can understand, feel at home in. The whole concept of halacha is slightly alien to them. It's old-fashioned, outmodish. You have this tremendous chasm. You have it in Orthodox shuls. You have it in conservative shuls at that time. Rabbis observe Shabbat, rabbis observe Kashrut. The masses? What Shabbat? What Kashrut? What Tarat Mishpacha? And yet they're not reformed, they want a conservative temple, they want a little bit Hebrew, they want Zionism. Remember, Yitz alluded to it, the Reform movement was terribly anti-Zionist. It started to change after World War II, I have to be honest. But the tradition of anti-Zionism was there. But there was another factor, not just the religious factor. There was a social factor, an economic factor. The Jew is becoming Americanized. Following World War II, he's making a good living. There's a boom in America. You want to get away from the city. Moves, it's trends. Today, of course, the trend has been reversed. But people are starting to have cars. Highways are being built. Who has to live in a crowded city? Who has to live in a city where there are robberies and murders and you don't see grass and children have no room to roam? And before you know it, the Jews are 10 miles away, 20 miles away, 30 miles away, 40 miles away. Take Long Island as an example. Look at the Long Island Railroad. Jews are all the way out. Got to get into Manhattan, you travel. Business opportunities. Well, suburbia, it's not like New York, it's not like Brooklyn, not like Manhattan, not like the Bronx. Brooklyn, you can have a shul every block. There are enough Jews living there to fill the shul. The Bronx, where I grew up, Washington Avenue, was called the Street of the Shuls. On Washington Avenue, we must have had something like, from 170th to Tremont Avenue on Washington, we must have had something like 10 different shuls, various sizes, shtiblach, ashkenaz, sfad. No shul spoke to the other shul. There was total enmity. I told you, the only time they came together was to build an eruv to take a Sefer Torah in 1944 out to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Yemach Shmo V'Zichro, as he passed by, to let him kiss the Torah. By the way, a book just came out justifying Roosevelt already. Some Jew wrote a PhD thesis, much more friendly to Roosevelt, etc., etc. It was his advisors, didn't know the war, this, that. Baloney. Look, in suburbia, you're going to build a shul every block. You know what that means? You'll have two Jews davening in the shul. A guy has a home, a swimming pool, a big yard, a lawn. So you see, you have conservative temples. Orthodox Jews have no choice. You have to build the shul, you have to conglomerate the Jews around the shul, you have to get them all together, there has to be a cohesive unit, they have to be within walking distance. Every Orthodox shul becomes a big draw because real estate people know that it now has raised the value 20 to 30% of all the homes 1 mile around the shul, a mile and a half around the shul. But the conservatives, all right. And now you come to the state of the rabbinate in America. This problem still exists until today. A rabbi is the sabbat and the servant. of the congregation. How much power does he really have? The pressures on him are indescribable. Balabhatam come to you, questions, problems, you have to give answers. Orthodox rabbis, the problems we have. Marriage, mamzerut, family purity, gerut. The conservative movement, he had many rabbis, were well-meaning, in their own lives, quite dedicated. The proof is many of them raised children who became tremendous B'nai Torah. I can give names, but it's not important now. But they put pressure on. Either we never get to temple, or we have to drive on Shabbat. People travel. People have to eat. You fellas have grown up in a dream world where I can say, Eidat Nemanah, you can go to the other end of the world. I was at the other end of Australia, the Barrier Reef. Mamish Yekvelt. I go into the supermarket across the street from the hotel, endless products with Hefsherim, imported from France, brought down from Melbourne, Sydney. You didn't go hungry? I can get along on bagels, pizza, jelly, peanut butter, tuna. Wow. You can travel the length and breadth of America and never lack for kosher food. It's a different world today. The Hechsherim, the OU, the Chavkei, the OK, the drive for kosher food, the a $5 billion plus industry. They just had a kosher fest in New Jersey. They say it was beyond words. You can't even imagine how much kosher food was on display and the mob scenes that were there, Jew and Gentile, black, white, everyone looking for the latest kosher delicacy. But here, 45, 49, 50, people are traveling. Rabbi, if we can't eat fish in a treif restaurant, we'll eat treif altogether. Can't go hungry. And all over America, this tremendous pressure was picking up. So here, when you look at the conservative movement, and you have to see it against the social economic background at that moment in time, and the conservative movement was extremely powerful then. It's not like today. Today, there are reasons why the so-called conservative movement is so weak and having so much difficulty. But here they were at their apex. You had these millions of East European people who still had some residue feeling from a grandfather, a great-grandmother, who wanted something more than reform, and yet were totally Americanized and totally ignorant over what Judaism is about. So you have the seminary. Seminary, per se, by 1950, this is what's unbelievable. It's much more orthodox than it's ever been. By 1950, Mordechai Kaplan, as I told you, is persona non grata. Mamish, a rebellion against him. There were faculty members who didn't speak to him. They wanted to force him out at every opportunity. They finally got him out a few years later when he turned 75, and he was very bitter. You read his memoirs, he was in the height of power yet. It's like someone telling me, Lahavdil, and not Mordechai Kaplan, but how would I feel? My brother tells me he can't operate anymore. My brother, turn 70, you cannot do an operation in Israel, finished. So, all right, he's teaching in medical schools, fine. I couldn't believe it, you can't operate now. Someone else turned 70, told me the same story. They can't operate anymore. All right, that's the law in Israel. Evidently, yes, there may be a doctor's handshake and they don't want to run a problem, so they made a rule, 70 years of age, no matter how good you are, that is it. Okay. They got rid of Mordechai Kaplan, 75, pushed him out. The seminary faculty, Louis Ginsburg, is already a shtickle about sugar in his old age. Louis Finkelstein, Reb Shaul Lieberman, the people that Reb Shaul Lieberman brings in, Sofer, the Zimitrovsky, one after another. From people. But then you have the United Synagogue. United Synagogue already is the collection, the cohesive unit of all the temples, the length and breadth of America. And they're demanding changes. They're demanding rabbinic sanction. They are no longer willing to toe the mark. They have the problems. How do you build a conservative temple far out in Long Island if, in order to get 20 Jews Shabbos morning, you have to take in an area of 5 miles on the map? And these are real problems. And remember, the commitment to halacha, it's not the way we approach these problems. They already, Catholic Israel, tradition and change, Mayor Waxman's famous book, they are creating tremendous pressure. And they're not willing to toe the mark. So it's almost a total contradiction. The seminary faculty is moving more right, and the United Synagogue is moving more left. Caught up in this conflict is, of course, the Rabbinic Assembly. Rabbinic Assembly, hundreds of rabbis, the leading spiritual leaders of the Jews in America, among them world famous rabbinic leaders, and they're caught in the middle. The pressures on them are from both sides. They're, many of them, in their personal lives, from. Many of them committed to their mentors at JTS. On the other hand, they're out there in the field. The pressures are indescribable. The people have legitimate, valid requests. They're caught up with tradition and change. They're caught up with the historical school. They're caught up with Catholic Israel. How do you keep the halacha intact? Gentlemen, we have arrived. In 1948, the Rabbinic Assembly came up with an unbelievable idea that has no precedent in halacha and actually is halachically totally incorrect. The Committee on Jewish Law enlarged its membership to 23. Why 23? What reason did they give? You learned the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Prechet Amid Bet, 23, Sanhedrin Katan. They didn't say, excuse me? They didn't say 71, but 23, Sanhedrin Katan. The Committee on Jewish Law. Before, the committee had 3, 4, 5 members, whatever. They didn't have any set number. Now they have 23. But watch. This is the chap. If you're familiar with the Gemara, Pechet Amid Bet, you should be familiar with the Gemara. It's a whole daf, and it's looking to the Rambam, Hilchot Mamrim, Perek Aleph at the end, Perek Bet. How does Torah work? How does Torah work? We're always going to have questions. Why do we have questions? First of all, we forget tradition. Originally, when it came to Torah Sheba'al Peh, and you all know by now Torah Sheba'al Peh has what we learned from the Yud Gimel Midah, Torah Sheba'al Peh has Perish Mekubal, something that's a traditional explanation. Torah Sheba'al Peh has Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai. The Rambam defines all this. Originally, on Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai and Perish Mekubal, do you understand these terms? I mean, I'll give you a very simple example. Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai, you put on tefillin this morning, Shmuel? What color were your tefillin? Blue and white. You're a big Zionist. Could you put on tefillin like that? Why not? Why not? Blue and white. I want to put on tefillin blue and white. I don't like the color black. You know that. Black means sin. Mourning. I don't like sin. I don't like mourning.
Besides, the tefillin only has four parshas. The fifth one, which is my favorite, is not in there.
Yitzchak, don't revise the tefillin. Yet halacha l'moshe mi-sinai tefillin are black. What is Perish Mukubal? No, you celebrated Sukkot. What did you take? A lemon? A grapefruit? Mendel, what did you take? An etrog? How do you know that a pre-eight sadah is an etrog? No, the Hasugin Mesechet Sukkot Aflamet. Perish Mukubal. It's never a machlok. But then you start to forget, so questions come up. Eidin Mukudash. How do you dashen? Do you dashen? Is there a tradition? Isn't there a tradition? Amida Chatur and Drashen. No, that can be a machloket. Then the Gezerah and Takana. That's also part of Torah Shebaal Peh, but it's rabbinic. The others are midoraita. No, there can be a machloket. Do we outlaw having more than one wife? Don't we? Have the mayor rabbanim. Today, you know, many Gedolei Yisrael, the Rav, was totally opposed to Het Demei Rabbanim Bizman Hazeh. All right. Rabbi Sauer Velay challenged Rabbi Wurzberger. They're both Talmudim of the Rav, but one from the 30s and one from the 40s, one from the 70s. Rabbi Sauer said it's impossible that the Rav could have said he's opposed to Het Demei Rabbanim. So you have to open up Rakepit's work, and you get the exact source where the Rav said it. It's on a tape. You can all hear it. Rav repeated it many times. I've heard it now on tapes at least three different shiurim. All right, they can be machloket. But when there is machloket, what do we do? No, quote the Gemara to me. We go to the local Beit Din. If the local Beit Din can't do it, then we go to a bigger Beit Din, Chaf Gimel. If the Chaf Gimel doesn't know, we go to the three big Batei Dinim in Yerushalayim until you reach the Beit Din of Ayin Aleph that sits in the Har Habayit. They put it to a vote. And we have to follow majority decision. If you don't follow majority decision, you are a, give me the words, a zakein mamre. You are chayav mita. It's an unbelievable concept. Why? Because we want one Torah, not two Torahs. And that's the way halakha works. And I will elaborate on this for 20 years once I finish the Besamim Rosh Bezrat Hashem. What's the matter, Yitzchak?
It's like having an insurance policy.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
I know.
The Ribbono Shel Olam will be kind to us. Yitzchak, that's the concept. We want one Torah, not two Torahs. And the Gemara cries that they ultimately forgot when Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel, and Esther, Torah, Kishtei, Torah, we had to find a solution. And this is why after Churban Bayit and after the Great Exile and after everything that happened to us, today we have differences because there's no focal authority. But originally the concept was when you ask a Beit Din, you get one answer. And this is the way the Dalit Chalkei Shulchan Aruch work. This is the way a Beit Din works. Now, it's true. Today, and I don't want to go into more detail, you'll see it all in the Rambam, Hatom LeMishnah Torah. It's true that today you can have a Sephardic Beit Din, an Ashkenazic Beit Din, but one thing is for certain. You get one answer, and that answer obligates you. We who are Ashkenazim, we cannot eat legumes on Pesach. Sephardim can eat legumes. Legume derivatives, they're already, there are many different opinions, and there's room already, lahakel, lahachmir. But there's some flexibility. But everything is clear. Gentlemen, the conservative movement, the rabbis faced a tremendous dilemma here. They can't give one answer. People are pulling in all different directions. And they came up with a very innovative idea. There can be many answers. from the Committee on Jewish Law. The only time an answer is binding on every conservative Jew is when the decision is unanimous. When it's not unanimous, there is Bechira Chavshet.
And then it's 22-1.
Give me one more second. Any opinion that has 3 votes or more is no longer unanimous. So you can have on any question the Committee on Jewish Law has asked a majority opinion, a minority opinion, a smaller minority opinion, a third even smaller minority opinion. You can divide up, as long as you get more than 3. 3 or more, I should say.
It's 7.
3 or more, it's a valid opinion. Well, you never had 7. The most you had in the question was 4 different opinions. But the only binding question that ever was asked and came back at that time, it's frightening to think what's happened today, but at that time was you cannot marry a non-Jew. No rabbi can officiate at a wedding where one of the partners has not converted. That was the only issue which was unanimous. Every other question that came up, and remember, these were important questions. These were not the minorly questions. These were questions that shaped the entire conservative movement. You had choice. 3 or more, valid opinion. Generally speaking, the majority of conservative Jews followed the minority opinion. And the minority of conservative Jews followed the majority opinion. Generally speaking, the classic example is riding to Shul on Shabbos, where only 3 of the 23 were willing to permit it, and yet that became the overwhelming majority, followed the so-called minority opinion. And it's the classic example. I'm going to go into detail. I'm going to actually read to you that the tshuva permitting riding. Let me just summarize.
The problem was it wasn't a matter of following positions. They were doing what they were doing.
I understand.
The RA was dealing with issues
that
the congregants were already doing.
No. So
the driving issue existed. Well, someone didn't come and say, Rabbi, can I drive to Shul and Shabbos?
That I understand.
They were doing it.
I understand. They want the justification. I understand.
They didn't even want that. The rabbis wanted the justification.
I understand.
The rabbis wanted to justify what their congregants were doing.
Yeah, but you have to know that among the conservative Jews, I know some who, you know, drove the shul on Shabbos, and they wanted the rabbi to approve it. And when it came before the Committee on Jewish Law, this was a very serious question, because the rabbis could have said absolutely prohibited. So it's like you say, it's like some Orthodox shuls that have parking lots that are open on Shabbat. Are you aware that in Memphis, Tennessee, the Baron de Hirsch Synagogue, as far as I know, don't know if it changed, their parking lot is open on Shabbat. That was the compromise made, that they shouldn't secede and go down the block and open a conservative temple. In Atlanta, Georgia, believe it or not, La Briud, in the big Orthodox shul where Rabbi Feldman is rabbi, the son of the Rabbi Feldman who came in Aliyah, the parking lot is open on Shabbat. It's a psat from Rav Ruderman, and I saw it in my own eyes.
They actually gave a psak that it's okay.
Yeah, for that community, they tell me. And they tell me all the people who originally drove to shul on Shabbat became shomrei Shabbat and bought homes closer to the shul.
And there were conservative shuls up until certainly the late 60s.
Yeah.
Where the parking lots were chained.
Yeah, the original, right, consent.
Absolutely.
No, you're absolutely right. And I understand what you're saying. But this, And but again, then there were rabbis who were anxious to still look. I don't want to make analogies, but you see what's happening now in the Orthodox world. Women are leading, are becoming shluchei tzibur. So what does this tell you? Rabbis are sending them. So you see, it's not just the congregants, but there are rabbis. We have to step out there. We have to help them. We have to justify. We have to take away the guilt feeling. We have to show that Judaism is amenable to change, that there's modernity, that the sands are shifting. Don't you hear this? Didn't I hear this the other night from a Rebbetzin and quoting another Rebbetzin? When there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way. So, gentlemen, you got a long way to go to show me that that's
true.
Yeah.
That's part of the rabbinical assembly.
Yeah, of course,
so
of course.
Do they have to go to
the Committee on Jewish Law, the Halachic Commission, is what the RCA called its committee.
Was there any formal thing that said that they had to take people from JTS?
What do you mean to JTS? They had to take people from rabbinical assembly.
And when they increased it to 23, were they like stacking it? Were they taking?
No, they took, I knew some of them, they took the more learned graduates of JTS, some were faculty members, but they took people who had some concept of learning. There was a Rabbi Newlander from Lawrence, I mean...
people who were rabbis of shuls already.
Yeah, no, of course, no, it was shul-oriented. They consulted, there's no question, they would consult with faculty members, they would consult with Professor Liebman.
It wasn't saying that there would be 23 members of the JTS faculty.
No. Rabbinic Assembly, again, there were three pillars to the conservative movement. JTS, United Synagogue, Rabbinic Assembly. It's like saying, YU, okay, RCA, OU. You can't say the OU with the RCA and YU walk hand in hand. You're dealing with three different bodies, three different organizations. There is an interrelationship, obviously. The OU technically will ask the RCA shilas, but the RCA never gets shilas from the OU because they have Rabbi Belsky and they have Rabbi Schechter, who are the poskim. And the OU accepts them as poskim, and the RCA doesn't want to rock the boat. They're very happy. Rabbi Schechter is certainly an RCA person. Rabbi Belsky has a sterling reputation. So Baruch Hashem, and there are many issues. It's very interesting. Rabbi Belsky is more Mekhil than Rabbi Schechter. So it's very fascinating how labels, Torah Vadas and Yeshivas from Kochanan, you can't give labels. But the Committee on Jewish Law consisted of 23, I'll put it this way, of the more learned and more erudite of the conservative rabbinate. To say that they were Gedolei Yisrael, chas v'lila. To say that they knew how to learn on the level of a good YU graduate, I have my doubts. But these were people who had a zikah, had some connection to learning, had some knowledge. One of them I knew was a conservative rabbi of a traditional conservative temple in the five-town area, and I had cousins who went there, and they knew him very well. This is before the big push back to Torah. Today they wouldn't go into a synagogue like that. And he always used to tell his congregants, if there would be a Sanhedrin today, I would be a member of the Sanhedrin. In other words, he was a member of the Chaf Gimel. So he got, and he knew how to learn. I want to tell you, and he was from in his personal life. And I'll show you, you'll see the names. I'm going to next week show you names, show you truth, but let you feel what we are speaking about. So to reiterate, my dear students, Professor Liebman, it's not easy to understand him because, on one hand, he was strictly Orthodox. It's not like Solomon Schechter or Louis Ginsberg. Even Louis Finkelstein was a little bit involved in the historical school, but Professor Liebman was a Gaon Shebagoyim, was the Chazalish's first cousin, and you couldn't, as I told you, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein took his class to see him. Remember what I told you last week? Avishai David, Rabbi David, is a living proof of it, and they were just blown away by the man's knowledge. Kol HaTorah Kulo was munach lefanav kekupsa. La, like you open up a box and you have coins there and dollars and shekel and everything organized. That's the way everything was in front of his face. He knew everything. So, but nevertheless, the difference between Professor Liebman, Professor Heschel, it's very fascinating. I turned it around to the Rav and Rabbaran, and it is correct, Rav Shmuel Soloveitchik, I can understand Rav Shmuel already because he appreciated both worlds. He still remembered Europe, and he could understand America. So you see, all right, these are theories. When we say, when we give theories, we hope we're correct. It makes sense, but you accept that as a theory. There's no question that the seminary remained a difficult force to understand, and the letter from Rav Moshe to Professor Louis Ginsberg about Rav Yitzchak Kuttner is classic in showing you this quagmire, in showing you this klayim, this shatnes, we can call it. This is in 245, with the close of World War II, with the Americanization of the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, people who no longer spoke Yiddish, people who no longer remembered a rough from the Alpha came, with the move to suburbia, and the Oishkeshkreit shuls, I don't know how to say that in English, spread out so far, and the pressures, the United Synagogue, and the Rabbinical Assembly comes up with an amazing idea, Committee on Jewish Law, Chaf Gimel, and all that follows. My dear students, next week is not just next week. Shabbat is a very special lecture. 99,000 commitment to do good deeds to get into the lecture, to the IOU list. It doesn't go chinam in kesef. When the Rebbe had a theory, and now it is no longer a theory, it is fact, this is a great moment in time. The lecture on Shabbos, something to the effect of riding the waves of life, Danny. A new development or a new fact in the Rav's life. Wow. If you love the Rav, love Torah, have a feel for Torah history, you will consider 99,000 good deeds a bargain for the Shabbat lecture, to be followed by Sunday, Monday continuation of all that we are doing. I want to share with you a number of matters. Number one, if you saw Friday's post, there's a letter to the editor by Harry Amdura, a fabulous letter to the editor against people who complain against Yiddishkeit and the rabbis. Harry Amdura once told his life story here in the Kollel. He was estranged from Yiddishkeit from the age of 30 to 40 approximately, and someone told him, listen to Rakefet's Sheyurim on the website. And what came out of it is unbelievable. I called him, he's a Magid Shir, and he lives in Ranana today, teaches at Daf Yomi, big Talmud Chacham, and I called him to give him a Yasher Koyach. Believe me, there are many reasons I'm going to wind up in heaven, but this is one of them. Finally, I have two copies for any of you who have a romantic heart, who love Torah and love life. Gentlemen, I picked up Yisrael Hayom last week. This is the freebie they give out. Kol HaKavod to this freebie. 800,000 copies distributed a day. It brought down Ehud Olmert. It saved Jerusalem. It saved the Kotel. If I'll be in Las Vegas, I'm going to try to thank Sheldon Adelson personally. Here's a beautiful article, Ashrenu Shezachinu Lekach, that this soldier finishes his course to become an officer. When you finish course katsinim, there is a fallout ceremony. Right after the ceremony, his friends in the course put down a white carpet, flowers on the side. He marched down the white carpet and bowed before this young lady who was his chanicha in Bnei Akiva and proposed marriage to her. And I want to tell you, this little article made me a very, very happy man. So if anyone wishes, two copies for the taking. And let me say to you, Besorah Tovah, Yeshua Mechamat, Aleinu V'Kol Yisrael, don't forget to take the Lieberman article if you're interested. This is the Phillips letter, the newspapers, if anyone is interested. And until we meet again, in health and happiness, when Noach small will be Noach great. Das Vedanya. Danny, do me a favor.